Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, the same two gentlemen that were here last week to help talk about BVS DOJ. It is our benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Raup.
Hello.
And Dan Mecca.
Can't wait for BVS Part 2, baby.
Dan, it's called Justice League Part 1.
Sorry.
JLP1.
The Holy Trinity is back.
Indeed we are. The response to our last was so rousingly positive, of course, that we decided to have everyone back because we knew that's what the people would want. Today we are talking about a different film that involves people with extranatural abilities. That is Midnight Special, the newest feature from writer-director Jeff Nichols, who's previously made a splash with Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and Mud. This movie stars Michael Shannon, Joel Edgerton, Kirsten Dunst. Why was I going to call her Kristen? That's not what her name is. And Jaden Lieberher. Please tell me that someone knows how to pronounce his name.
Jaden Lieberher.
All right, well, we'll just stick with that. It also has appearances from Adam Driver and Sam Shepard. That is all we're going to be talking about today, so let's clear out the housekeeping fairly quickly so we can get to that. You can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can find these episodes on thefilmstage.com where you can comment on the pages that they are posted under. And you can find us on iTunes where you can comment and leave us a rating. We always greatly appreciate that. And of course, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. All that stuff out of the way, let's just dive right in. Let's talk about Midnight Special.
Police issued an amber alert for an 8-year-old boy. He was abducted from his home near El Dorado, Texas.
It's time, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you know about Alton Meyer?
I wouldn't know where to start. He would have fits.
Things would break. It was like a feeling.
Kind of feeling.
So that is the trailer for Midnight Special. Like I said, newest film from Jeff Nichols. This film concerns itself with a father who is trying to transport his son across the United States to get him to a certain set of coordinates. His son, imbued with special abilities that no one seems to understand, he is pursued by both the cult that had been viewing his son as a prophet and messiah, and the U.S. government, which views him as a possible weapon. The father is aided only by his childhood friend, Lucas, played by Joel Edgerton. So, gentlemen, let's talk about it. What did we think of Midnight Special? And if you could each begin by staying very briefly what you thought of Jeff Nichols' last films, whatever ones you may have seen, I think that would help to add some context. So Jordan Raup, let's start with you.
Sure. Yeah, well, I won't specifically dive into each Jeff Nichols film, but I think he is one of these directors, and I could probably name, you know, 5 or 6 off the top of my head, where I love his approach to filmmaking. I love his process. I think he one day will make a flat out like fantastic movie, but I love his, you know, what he's doing. And, Midnight Special is another one in this string of films. And I really enjoy the way he kind of lets information, not come to the surface initially, or at all, perhaps. And he just kind of keeps things kind of at his own pace, which I really enjoy, but never, you know, this is not like a, Haneke movie or something where it feels like, you know, slow. Even Take Shelter, I think, had a lot of great momentum to it, and Mud, and Shotgun Stories for that matter. So with this latest one going into sci-fi, I really enjoyed it. I will say, though, I found the dramatic elements a little more interesting than that actual sci-fi, and I think we can probably jump into spoilers after we each talk, because there's a lot to discuss. But I really enjoy the way he kind of conjures up these moments of wonder. There's a scene in a gas station that is one of the best scenes I probably will see this year. The acting top from bottom is fantastic. So I really like what he's playing with and the ideas he's working with. But I wouldn't say I flat out love the movie, and we can go into why. But another really solid effort from him and one that I highly recommend.
All right, Dan Mecca.
Yeah, so I really like Jeff Nichols. I've seen all four of his films. I don't know, Jordan. I don't even know if you. I might have just missed you saying this. I know it's Take Shelter your favorite of his four. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah. So it's funny because that is my least favorite of his four. Now, I do like the film, but I think we've talked about this before. I have some problems with Take Shelter that kind of a divisive movie in some ways. I think Jeff Nichols, the biggest compliment you can give him is he is, you know, a living, breathing example of the power of original storytelling in modern cinema, which is to say, you know, even with Midnight Special, which there is somewhat of a budget here, this is a guy who's creating really kind of, you know, informed, homage-driven tales that at the same time feel wholly original and are wholly original. And my personal favorite of his four is Mud. Though I do love Shotgun Stories for similar reasons. And Midnight Special, there's a lot I like about it. I think I skew towards Jordan's general demeanor of it. I think not unlike Mud, towards the third act, things happen that kind of go in directions that are, you know, that are pronounced and decidedly what they are. And I think some people can find everything positive about that, and some people can kind of maybe feel that the tail turns away from them a little bit without kind of jumping into too much. I don't know, really, honestly, with Midnight Special, I don't fully know where I sit there yet. I saw the film a week or two ago and I'm still letting it marinate, but obviously I've thought about it a lot, and I think his movies, I've thought about every single one of them that I've seen, you know, even Take Shelter, there's plenty to chew on, plenty frames to think about. So ultimately positive on the film. I definitely want to try to, you know, kind of point out the flaws as we move forward just so we can have an interesting discussion about it. But I really enjoyed it, and, you know, curious to see what you thought, Brian.
Take Shelter had been my favorite of his films, and I think this one may have outdone it, actually. I found this to be a very richly textured, interesting, driving, just beautiful and ultimately moving film. I think a lot of what it has to say about the importance that people place in people and the lack of any true meaning that most of those meanings have when it comes down on a personal level is very interesting. I think a lot of what it has to say about fathers and sons and really parents and children in general is very interesting. I would have been moved by this movie no matter what. I think the fact that I'm going to be a father soon had something to do with my reaction to it. I think it just that fact of life will like prime you to understand something like this on a level it's meant to be understood. Sort of like how you can watch Titanic when you're a kid and it's just like, why isn't the boat hitting the iceberg yet? But once you've actually grown up and like fallen in love, you might better understand some of the more melodramatic instances in that film. I think it does depend on where you are and what you're feeling and have felt and are preparing to feel on a very real level to connect in a certain way with this. Definitely happy that we have an original film in theaters. I'm real burned out already on adaptations and whatnot. And we're not even like a quarter of the way through the year yet. Oh, no, I guess we are a quarter of the way through the year yet, aren't we?
Pretty much exactly. Yeah.
Well, thank God for that, I guess. But, I found Midnight Special. I hesitate to say flawless. There must be flaws. even in, you know, something like Tree of Life, there are flaws. But it's an immaculate emotional experience wrapped up in, I would say, a fairly affecting 80s style sci-fi flick. And I enjoyed it greatly. Even the parts where I could feel it edging towards a bit of hokiness, the emotional truth of these characters really reeled it in for me and kept it grounded and kept it fun and interesting and moving. And it's the type of movie that we're getting less and less of. It's distressing to think that people might go into this and be put off by how much these people matter to each other and how much time it takes to do certain things. And in the end, how small it is, despite the reality bending nature of its story. So yeah, I'm a huge fan. Definitely top 10 of the year so far.
It's funny that you say, you know, a movie we're getting less and less of, because I was kind of thinking about this. It's one of those things. I agree with you on a macro level, right, about what you're saying about a movie we're getting less and less of. But it's funny because movies like this, you know, your Starman's, your original sci-fi, you know, Looper. Looper's a relatively recent, you know, obviously offering that. I feel like that film and this film have a modicum of similarities. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
think you could say like country sci-fi.
You could certainly say
crazy
like
kids,
crazy, just crazy kids. You know, just the middle of America. You know what I mean? A lot of stuff. But I don't know. It's interesting. Movies like this, you know, I think we have what Duncan Jones' Mute is hopefully coming relatively soon, unless I'm totally mistaken.
Yeah,
so I mean,
shooting it this fall. Yeah.
Right. So I think, you know, I don't know.
You're
going
to say his World of Warcraft.
Right. I don't know how common these ever were. I mean, small sci-fi that
were. Just saying more or less, you know, like a personal mid-budget.
Yeah, mid-budget certainly. And that's what I'm saying. When I say macro, I think, you know, that definitely mid-budget is definitely true. And I think
I wasn't even really talking about the sci-fi aspects.
And even the way, it's released or being released, in which it's, you know, platforming and doing okay and hopefully people see it. But I mean, this obviously in the 90s or the 80s would be a film that would have come out wide with some sort of, you know, opening dollar signs, but that's not quite the case these days. So that is, in its own way, you know, disappointing. But, you know, with Jeff Nichols, I think what's just interesting is how much this film is different from everything he's done and so very similar. And I think that really does speak to his kind of, you know, continual growth as an auteur who uses genre staples, you know, to kind of fit into his own aesthetic and scope and whatnot. And I will say, I think, just to get more specific, this might be my favorite Joel Edgerton performance.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think, I don't know what it was about his performance, but it feels so, you know, authentic. And he's kind of our outlet or our inlet, whatever you want to say. He's almost the audience's
He's one of the few people in this story who has 100% no idea what's happening.
Yeah. And I mean, and he represents, you know, the friend, right? The person who's like ride or die. And, you know,
I don't know what it is, but like, I love a movie. I was telling this to my fiance on our way home from the theater. I love a movie where you have two guys who are friends. And like, maybe they haven't spoken in a while, but then like one friend shows up looking for help and the other one's just like down for it. There's something like, you don't see a lot of normal, just decent, good, healthy friendships in film. There's always some issue that has to be worked out.
Especially in this movie, I think, because doesn't he say, he's like, oh yeah, he came by just a few days ago and now I'm all in.
He's talking to Kirsten Dunst and you're like, I kept expecting to kind of just find out the way you find out everything in this movie, just kind of slip in, find out that they were brothers who were like estranged or something like that.
Right. Yeah, like he left the cult and one stayed in. Yeah, something like
that. He's like, yeah, we were friends growing up, and then his parents took him to this cult, and then 3 days ago he showed up, and I was just like, okay. It's just like,
I really, Joel Edgerton. I guess we want to talk about, because some of the complaints I hear most from people is kind of the way they reveal information, and I had, or the lack thereof, and I had really no problem with that. My own.
Oh, that's bullshit to me. I loved the way that information was parsed out in this
film. The one aspect of that, which is strange to me when people say that, because I think he actually revealed too much information in terms of the sci-fi elements. I think there's one scene where should we go into spoilers? I feel like everyone got our general gist.
Yeah, I mean, this.
Yeah, so go see this movie.
If we have any issues that are going to come across with each other, it's going to be in the stuff that gets revealed. So, I mean, we're all saying see this, right?
Yes, yes.
And it's just varying levels of how good it is. I would say 9.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if seeing this, you know, gets you to go see Mud and Shotgun Stories.
Oh, yeah, you know. I brought my fiance home, and we immediately watched Take Shelter.
Like, straight up, I mean, as, you know, hopefully people are listening, you know, that can, you know, I will say, I don't know if there's a person who wouldn't like Mud. Am I wrong? Right? Like, that movie is so likable. I don't know. You know what I mean? The first time I saw it, I was kind of mixed on it, I remember. But then the second time I rewatched it, and that movie has everything. I mean, that is just, like, pure entertainment. You know what I mean? Whereas I think Take, you know, intense and, you know what I mean? There's potentially more going on emotionally. Maybe not everybody wants to be involved in a movie like that, and I get it. But Mud is straight up fun and, like, just like a Huck Finn, Mark Twain-y awesome time. So it's like, you know, go see this and then go watch that. That would be my kind of recommendation.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what I was going to say, now that we're in spoiler territory officially, is – so, I mean, there's a kind of a question. I think he's trying to set up a question is this other world existing, or is everything going to come true in terms of, you know, what this boy possesses and the power that they believe in him? And I never really, as soon as there's the scene when, you know, you see his light, the crazy transference of light beams into the eyes of the other guy that they visit, it was kind of, I was like, oh, okay, so this kid is definitely from another world and things are going to get crazy. And so when there's that ultimate revelation of, you know, the almost Tomorrowland-esque world that's on top of them, I guess he did a good job of building up throughout the movie, but I don't think it was as grand as I was hoping for.
I hear that from a lot of people. What more were you hoping for?
Not hoping for, but in the sense that, throughout the movie does such a fantastic job of just sneaking in little bits of information. And I think he said in an interview, this movie could easily be part two of a trilogy that we'll never see the other parts of. And I like that aspect where you just pick things up and then you just let them go. But there, for me, if he was trying to build an aspect of mystery towards the sci-fi elements, I don't think it's not an even of an arc as the drama, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, so to kind of jump off your point, Jordan, I think, and maybe this is a kind of a, you know, obviously writing these types of things is immensely difficult, so it's kind of hard to be overly critical. But when thinking about it after we saw the movie, one thing I kind of wished for, once you get this reveal of this, like, we're in spoilers, right? I just want to make sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So once we get this reveal of this, like, Tomorrowland-like world, right, where it's like there's this almost this layer above our layer type thing, I like the idea, and I like that it was far more nuanced than Tomorrowland, you know, to be honest.
Yes. don't get me wrong on that part.
There's a strange elegance to the architecture there, and the trees, and the some of the buildings almost seem to breathe.
Yeah, no, I mean, so I liked everything about it, but I almost wished that maybe the Adam Driver character had an inkling of something like this, so that we were given almost, it's almost like, you know, in like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, the city or what they're looking for is hinted at, and it's like mythological. And then when you see it, there's some sort of built in, I don't know, you're ready for it in a way, but then it kind of one-ups you, right? You know what I mean? Like, it gives you a hint of it, right? So that's why when I want to say it's difficult to write these things, obviously too much of it, and then it's Tomorrowland, and I don't want that either. But I think if Adam Driver or someone like him, you know what I mean, had an inkling of this world a little bit more, as opposed to when it happens at the end, it feels very much like, oh, okay, that's what we're talking about, right? As opposed to maybe, oh, there it is. You know what I mean? There's, I understand now what we were all driving towards a little bit more. I don't know. Does that make any sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does. Not for
Brian.
It does, but I don't agree. Is that...
Yeah, I mean, so
I want to say it makes sense and make it sound like I agree with you.
No, but I mean, but you know what I mean is what I'm saying.
That would be so weird if Matthew Driver, or Adam Driver, why did I say Matthew Driver? What am I doing with people's names today?
Well, no, but so here's the thing, though. But when you say it would be so weird, though, why would it be so weird? That's kind of what I mean.
Because
I mean, you're creating a world, so you can make
it better if the world that we are living in has as much knowledge as the world that the characters are living in. And so if Adam Driver had been like, it's our belief that there's a extra dimensional world built on top of ours, I would just be like, well, why? Why would we think that? Like, where is that information coming from? I like
But it'd be like, if he was, you know, it's that conspiracy
fucking
theory.
Crazy?
No, because it's like there would be like scant evidence. You know what I mean? It would be just a nice addition.
There is no scant evidence. This movie is about a child unlike anything that anyone has ever known, who gives us an insight into a world unlike anything we've ever known. And I like that it comes seemingly out of nowhere, but from the mouth of this child who ends up being correct.
So let's really quickly transition what you're talking about, because I totally understand what you're talking about.
Right.
Let's transition it then to the final shot, right, which... Mm-hmm. Now, are we meant to believe in that final shot that Michael Shannon is one of them?
Or? Yeah, I think that, and you know, it's kind of one of these things where you sort of have to wrap your mind around what the possibilities are by this world. Why would these beings of seemingly pure energy, as we see them, like erect themselves atop of our world? And it might be the type of thing where, like, I had a very clear. Interstellar-y connection where it's like the people, spoilers for Interstellar, I guess, the people who were aiding us in Interstellar and giving us information were us. So that's how I felt about it. Like this is a future society of us who is watching us and mentoring us and moving us towards them. And Michael Shannon is like the first most weakest link in a chain that will lead to us, and his son is perhaps the greater link, the first being to actually move between the two.
So then why is Michael Shannon weakened then? I mean, because he's clearly affected by his son's powers, right? In throughout the film, he's affected by...
What do you mean affected by?
Because in the car, like for example, in the car, right, when his son freaks out and light goes everywhere, Michael Shannon is like physically affected by that power. And so I guess what confused me a little bit was...
Well, I mean, it's a fucking bright light.
Well, no, I know that. But I know that, but I'm meant
to... It's more than a bright light.
But I'm saying what I'm meant to believe, and, you know, I could be alone in this, right? But I'm meant to believe at the end of that film, at the end of the film, that if Michael Shannon were one of them, then why would his son's powers affect him the way it would affect other human beings? Do you know what I mean?
Because it's a question of evolution.
Okay, but that I didn't really read that.
Okay, well, I read that.
Do you know what I mean? I didn't read like Michael Shannon was. And why would that? I don't understand really why that would be. Yeah, I guess that's where me and you kind of are going to, you know, because I didn't really see the. So basically what you're saying is that the son is more powerful than the father, even though the father is, in fact, more than a human being.
Right. I would say that, you know, the son doesn't have to work at it. In fact, it's almost a burden for him to bear because it happens, you know, divorced of his trying, whereas the father never worked hard enough to tap into it. So, you know, the father might have been able to do what the son was doing if he tried really hard, but he never did because he didn't know about it. And the son has no ability to operate on a safer level at first because no one knows what's going on with him and he has no frame of reference. Jordan, did you have a feeling about this?
I can see that. I will say this, and what Dan actually referenced a little bit, but so the scene where he says goodbye to his son for the last time, you know, like when in the car or when he leaves the car and they go in the field and he knows that, you guys know what I'm talking about referencing.
Yeah.
And so I think I, as Dan was talking, I was kind of referencing or zeroing in on the issue I had. I think that scene more emotionally affected me than anything in the last 10 minutes. So it's almost a testament to the movie that I think it has this dramatic power. Were you more affected, Brian, by that brief exchange than, I guess what I'm saying is what we see is never as interesting as the unimagined, which I wish he kind of stuck with more.
So you're saying the reveal almost lessens the power of, yeah, I would generally agree with you. Like I appreciated the ending. And once again, you know, it's hard, especially after talking about a movie like Batman v Superman, right? which I mean, you know, we know, I think, you know, I probably defended more than either the two of you, but I will say, obviously, the nuanced creativity on display here is on a different level, of course. So
this is my thing. In a film like this, you have to strike a balance between the emotional catharsis of just what the characters are going through, but then also some sort of reveal for the plot. And I think that there's something beautiful about the way this film handles it. I mean, I sometimes wonder in our internet culture how people would have reacted to the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Because you go through this whole movie with the knowledge that there are probably aliens out there, that the government's trying to contact them. Then the aliens come back, redeposit a bunch of people who they'd abducted. Then they come out, and then the people go in, and Richard Dreyfuss is one of these people, and then they leave. And then I just imagine today people being furious that we didn't get to see what happens to Richard Dreyfuss or what's up with all these people that got off. Like, the concept of inherent mystery and payoff has become really hard to track in our culture. Because sometimes people are like, you know, you explain too much and it ruins everything. And then there are times when they say, this movie didn't explain anything. And I think that in general, this movie, you know, delivered its emotional catharsis first and then, you know, played around a little bit to give us more information at large, but to still leave us with questions. And so, you know, the emotional event horizon was definitely before Alton got to where he was going and opened up the portal and showed apparently the entire Gulf Coast. This new world that exists on top of ours. But I still liked what was going on. With the father and Lucas, Roy and Lucas, driving and seeing that glorious, glorious place just high above them. Very unobtrusive, very simple, very elegant and beautiful. And then their car, you know, flips over. And they're doing this because they're trying to draw people away long enough for Alton to do what he has to do. I mean, that was still moving to me. And the thought of a father having to say goodbye to his son in that way, because this is what is best for the son, and this is where the son belongs, you know, after he'd already had to give him up to this cult leader just because they were in a cult. I mean, that's a hard thing to put across, as, you know, finding your son and getting him back and then having to say goodbye again. So I think that this film actually did a very good job of splitting the difference in that way.
Yeah, it definitely feels very Joseph and Mary, you know, very Catholic, you know.
Well, that's another one. I'm Catholic, you know. So.
But you know what? It's interesting what you were saying. It is funny to your point about too little and too much in this day and age, where Batman v Superman probably gave us way too much, right? And was regarded in a way of that, right, by viewers and by critics, right, and this movie, you know, I think it's interesting that it's the opposite. You know what I mean? Coming out in the same kind of time frame, where it's, you have kind of a much smaller, you know, much more, you know, complicated take. I don't know, complicated is probably not the right word, but it is interesting that these two films really feel like two sides of the kind of genre coin. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Clearly well thought out. And I mean, the reason Jeff Nichols, I don't know if you guys read, there's an amazing Wired profile, which you should check out on, it's just on wired.com. And he just goes through every aspect, even test screenings and things like that, where like David Gordon Green, one of his good friends, is like, I think you went a little too far with like the lack of exposition, and but he kept with it. And he's like, and he even admits, we actually have an interview with him too on this on the film stage where he talks about that. And it's just interesting because literally he told Warner Brothers, like, I will make this movie only if I get Final Cut. That's it. And so you can just tell the difference in product where something's so clearly thought out from, you know, everything in all of his movies. I think there's just like a spirit that drives them from A to B to C. Well, and this one, clearly, there's never a moment where it feels like he's skipping a beat.
I mean, exposition. This is something weird that I've been harping on a lot of this year. For whatever reason in this podcast, is things that happen for the audience and things that happen for the characters. And this is a film that for most of its run doesn't seem to really care about the audience in a good way, because it doesn't sacrifice character in order to make a point for the audience. What we were talking about with exposition and our love of Lucas, the character played by Joel Edgerton, there's a point where he has to shoot a state trooper in the chest, and it's obviously shaken him. And Michael Shannon's saying, you know, he's wearing a vest, probably everything's okay. And Lucas just says, look, you're not the guy who just shot a state trooper. Like, let's back off. And so Michael Shannon does. Come to find out later that Lucas was outside of this ranch complex. Roy walked up to him and asked for help, and he said yes. And that he was a state trooper, which adds a whole other emotional layer and a whole other plot layer to everything that is going on with them. And it's a very simple, understated moment for the character, but it's so impactful for us as an audience. And I appreciate that. I loved that kind of action in this film and the way that most exposition is delivered that way.
Yeah, that's
not something we got in Batman v Superman. No.
That scene in particular, then the scene where they're in the hotel room and then they get attacked. I think Dan and I both were like, because we saw this next to each other. And I think those were the two scenes where you just knew that Jeff Nichols was not messing around. And this was like that first shootout and just like the cinematography in this movie, by Adam Stone, his regular guy. I think it's incredible the way he, you're not only learning information as the characters do, but you're also seeing it as the characters do. They could have filmed those two scenes in such different ways, and I think the way he does it is fantastic.
I did appreciate the scene where Kirsten Dunst plugs in the thumb drive and scrolls through Flash and
we just
Aquaman
get to see, we see like a 3-minute clip of.
I just think
doing
because I just think the beauty of that is it's really subtle, you know.
And it is.
I mean, it just really, you know, we're in spoilers, so we can talk about it. You really learn that Alton is Spider-Man and he's gonna be in the 2017.
Weird when they show her dyeing her hair red at the end, and then when someone asks her what her name is, she says, "I'm Mary Jane," and then you're just the hell?
Right.
Hey guys, at least Michael Shannon gets both the BVS money and the Midnight Special.
Oh,
money.
True. That's
does he get paid for like the three times that his corpse is in BVS?
Paid for being a cadaver.
So technically, because someone said that he shot scenes there, but then Jesse Eisenberg said it was just literally, it wasn't actually him. So I don't know. That's a great question.
I mean, it's his likeness. So
I'm gonna call Mike real quick and ask.
Yeah, call up Mikey on the phone.
Let me just mute it real quick, and I'm gonna call him.
What do you guys think of? So the one if I had a nitpick, one jump in logic for me was Adam Driver's character. I love the way he kind of is like. Kind of like a bumbling, like he like always checks his badge with the people there, and I really liked what he added to it. But the scene where he's like, it's almost like the Eureka scene in Interstellar, where he's like figuring out where they are, and it kind of comes from nowhere. It seems like. Did you have a problem with that? Like on the map?
I was hoping that he would give some exposition
I certainly had a problem with
that one scene. I was like, okay, come on, you have to give us a little more. It's not. That's the one scene.
It's literally, dude, it's funny too because the way it's shot, and Jay, we didn't actually talk about this, but it's funny the way that it's shot, and I was almost laughing while watching it. And this is such a small criticism, so I'm not. We're really just having fun, but like but it's shot like the scene where Chaz Palminteri figures out in Usual Suspects, he figures out the whole thing. But in that movie, you hear, like, you get the movie replayed for him figuring it out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's like that scene without that part of it. So you're just watching Adam Driver. You're like, what are you thinking about there, man? And then he's just like, I know where they are. And you're like, wait. How? How do? And by the way, I called Mikey Shands, and he said that weirdly 2 days on set, SAG minimum. So not a lot, but he did it as a favor to Zach. And
now the crazy thing there is I would think that Doomsday would still count as him because technically bred of his body.
Yeah, weirdly, that is a SAG loophole. Negotiations next year.
It's the classic Doomsday loophole.
You know how it is with this.
the classic Doomsday loophole.
They've deemed it the Doomsday loophole. Yeah, it's you know, look, you know, that's why they're unions. There'll be another meeting in a couple months.
It's so we'll like how Crispin Glover didn't come back for Back to the Future 2, so they like shot another guy upside down and far away.
Yeah, but Crispin Glover sued them for that though. I know he won.
Oh, well, maybe Mikey S.
We are about to get the most. We're going to get a more interesting court case than the one in Batman v Superman.
No. Mikey Shands doesn't sue.
Mikey Shands doesn't sue.
He's a gentleman. He told me that he wanted me to relay that to everybody on the pod.
Going back to the movie, did you guys also love the scene in the gas station as the meteors are crashing down? That was like the highlight of the movie, I think, for me on the sci-fi side.
Oh, that was a great scene. Yeah, I thought it
was fantastic how, you know, he's like, they're coming, and then just see it rain down.
What I like about that scene is that you know, people have mentioned Spielberg moments with this movie and whatnot. And I will say that is probably the moment that feels most like that, because I think up until that point, you're kind of like, what's up with this kid a little bit, right? And then when that happens, you're kind of like, oh shit.
See, like, I think this movie,
you know what I mean,
has much more realistic Spielberg moments, because like whatever wonder is immediately replaced by, oh shit, there's a satellite crashing. And then the next time there's wonder, like a car flips over, because that's just going to happen. I mean, there's a closer reality to it. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I mean, that whole Adam Driver thing, I was expecting him to explain it. I know that, you know, it's weird that he's just circling the things. But now I was trying to think, do they ever explain how the government finds E.T. in E.T.?
I have not seen that movie in a long time.
Say that again. What?
You know how Elliot comes home one day and like the spacemen are there and E.T. is like, did his mother call someone or like, I can't remember how the government found E.T.
I think from the moment he crashes, you're meant to think.
So they're on him, they're on him, and then they just find him.
I think so. That movie moves
at the beginning. Isn't the opening scene where they're collecting the samples like the...
Right. I just can't remember like how they wind up at Elliot's house.
Yeah, no, I think
every
the idea
once in a while in a film like this, you just kind of, you know, you don't forgive it, but there are narrative leaps that it takes, and you just kind of have to say, oh, because this guy is smart. Like every so often, you don't need to see the full process.
I'm sure
they could have added in a line or something, but I mean, it was obvious that this guy knew enough and was keyed in enough to really like, he became the acting field officer.
I think the leap you could make, and I could be kind of oversimplifying, but I think the leap you could make in that scene was that he basically stopped getting distracted by the perceived route based on like the church's comments, right? Right? Wasn't that like, it was basically like everybody was like, oh, they're going to be here because that's what everybody has said. But then Adam Driver's like, no, wait a minute. They're not following any logical
path. Right, it was something to do with the sermons that were being given by the kid.
Yeah, so basically in finding out that the sermons meant nothing, more or less, you know, that almost cleared his head. Like the half leap you could make almost, you know.
And that's the thing, like I didn't even bother to stop to think about it. Like when he circled those things and said, "Oh my God, I've got it." I was like, "Okay, he's got it. He's been proven to be a smart guy." I'm it's not like Lost. I'm not sitting there believing that the numbers mean something important and that if I read the right cereal box, I'll figure it out. because they've done the work to set Adam Driver up as a smart guy who's looking beyond where everyone else is looking, and that's going to put him ahead of them. That's all I need.
It definitely did a better job than Interstellar. That was my least favorite part with Jessica Chastain. And do you remember that scene where she, I think she literally like
she throws all the papers in the air, and you're like, Jess, pick up the papers. Those are crucial. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Maybe that was all of her old work, and she's like, you know what? I need to clear off my desk, and I have a really dramatic way to do it.
My favorite part of Interstellar, not to go on a tangent, but my favorite part of Interstellar is there's a part in the movie where, like, there's a half-intimate moment between Tover Grace and Jessica Chastain, and you're like, oh, are they dating? And then that's it.
That was an improvised moment.
Was it?
She just did it, yeah.
She like kisses him, right? Or something like that. Yep, and so you're literally like, oh, are they like boyfriend and girlfriend, not just coworkers? And then you're like, nah, who?
I mean, they've, you know, the tension's been building up over the years, but for a while he had a girlfriend and she was obviously.
This is the prequel we really need, guys. Come on.
We need Interstellar 1.5, which is just a romantic comedy between Topher Grace and Jessica Chastain.
What I need is Neil deGrasse Tyson's take on the Midnight Special is what I really need.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be accurate. I'm sure he would.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it'd be totally accurate.
The satellite thing, I believed, and
yeah, like totally.
Could a child bring down a satellite with their eyes, Neil deGrasse Tyson? That's what we need to know. If so, why do we have that gap in our national strategic defense?
I will say this as we're kind of winding down. I could have used more Kirsten Dunst. I thought she was strong, and I was a little disappointed we got to her so late. I mean, it makes sense with the story, so I don't really have a suggestion there. But you know, she was a welcome presence later on.
I love Kirstie D. So yeah, any more of her would have been great. But I liked what she had. I liked what she did.
She does good. She is one of the last people in the film. Well, I mean, that sees him, so she gets that catharsis.
I love the fact that he said this is like the second part of a trilogy that you'll never see the other parts to. Because part of me is like, you know, I'm super interested as to where this could go. But again, leaning on what I said previously, the more you explain, the less interesting it is. I mean, we all thought we wanted to know how Anakin became Darth Vader, and that didn't turn out well. So I like this as it stands. You know, if this made like $3 billion, I would say, please, dear God, don't make, you know, Daylight Special.
Oh, God.
Twilight Special.
Warner Brothers really should have done a better job, I think, pushing this out there. But what are you going to do?
I don't know why they had it. So I've seen a lot of advertisements for this. And then, you know, it's funny because I clicked on one on Facebook the other day. And there were people who were like, I fucking would if it were coming to Kansas City. I'm not just saying that because I think that's like a backwater. Someone literally said that. So
yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean for like, our listeners, it was New York, LA, and Austin for 2 weeks. And then this past Friday, it was 55 cities, not wide as they previously thought. So they definitely geared it back a bit for some reason, maybe because it wasn't doing amazing. I mean, it's doing fine, but not amazing. So like Dan said at the beginning, but go see this movie.
Yeah, I was about to say, I hope that everyone listening to this has a chance to see it. If not, when it comes out on Blu-ray and VOD, check it out, because this is a damn fine film by a really good American filmmaker. He's going to go places, this guy.
And just as we're talking about Jeff Nichols, he's got another movie coming out in September called Loving.
November,
called Loving, which is actually his first, I guess, historical nonfiction film. And it's about an interracial couple in Virginia. Is that right, Jordan?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Richard and Mildred Loving, an interracial couple, are sentenced to prison. Virginia in 1958 for getting
married. Right. And so, I mean, obviously very different from his past films, and I'm very much looking forward to that, you know, change of pace. So
yeah, Joel Edgerton.
Yeah. And he actually,
and Nick Kroll, what?
Yes, Nick Kroll, who's supposedly a very dramatic role, which will be interesting to see him play.
Oh, that's going to be difficult for me.
I know. I would also encourage, if you guys are interested, I'll pimp it out again, the interview, because I've never seen a filmmaker really open up the way he does. Like, he talks about this movie, which doesn't come out until November, and how he was completely paralyzed with fear while writing it, because he's has to really depict people that lived. And it was just interesting to hear him be so open about the process. So, and he goes more into depth about how, you know, how he pulled it off and stuff like that. So definitely check it out.
Definitely. All right. Well, that is all for today. We all liked this film, so it's not as interesting as
so much. So much agreement. It makes me sick. Oh,
I know.
I'm sick to my stomach.
Quickly,
I wish that this movie was worse, so the conversation could be more interesting. Isn't that right, Dan?
Yes. I like this movie a lot, and you know, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think it's nice to see original movies like this. I really enjoyed it. So, sadly, we all really liked it a lot. So,
sadly. All right, well, that's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Tune in next week when we'll be talking about Everybody Wants Some, probably.
It has two exclamation points, so you have to say it a little differently than that.
Everybody wants some!
Thank you.
There we go. We'll probably be talking about that, depending on if we're able to get out and see it.
I'm also happy to jump in next week on my hot take on my Big Fat Greek Wedding 2.
your 2 week old hot take.
my Big Fat Greek Wedding 2.
My lukewarm take.
We'll also be talking about what was that movie that's coming out?
The Jungle Book is getting a shocking 100% on Rotten Tomatoes to start out. So
that is crazy. I am reviewing that for the site, so we all can look forward to that. Oh God. Oh wait, no, that's next week. Thank you.
No, yeah, it's not next. It's the week after.
I was like, shit. Am I supposed to be at that right now?
I think Dan can also back me up in terms of looking forward to Green Room. I mean, we both saw it.
Oh, I'm totally looking forward to Green Room.
Oh yeah, I really enjoyed.
It's a very good film.
Very good film.
All right. Well, Jordan Raup, where can we find you online?
At the Film Stage and at JP Raup.
And Dan Mecca.
At bvsfanclub.com and also thefilmstage.com and my Twitter handle at DJ MECCA.
DJ Mecca.
That's me.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. And you can find me on thefilmstage.com. That's it. That's all I feel like saying this week. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next week.